she saw the motorboat out there, the only thing on the water. For a brief moment, she'd wondered if it was adults, someone coming to rescue them from the phase. But no. If rescue was coming from outside the phase, it wouldn't be a single open boat. And anyway, Astrid was convinced no one was coming. Not now. Probably not ever. She squinted, but could not tell who was on the boat. If only she had binoculars. It seemed like it might be three people. Maybe four. She couldn't tell. But the boat was speeding closer. She knelt to see what was still available in the minibar refrigerator. During their last stay, she and Sam and Quinn had almost cleaned it out. All that was left to eat were some cashews. She would need to feed little Pete sooner rather than later, before whoever was on the boat got here.
"Come on, Petey,"
she said, and guided him up from the end of the bed.
"Come on, we're going to get some food." "Munchy, munchy?"
she said, using a trigger phrase that sometimes worked.
"Munchy, munchy?"
They could head for the clifftop restaurant and probably find something there, maybe cook a chicken sandwich or something, or at least find some yogurt or whatever. Or they could play it safe and just empty out the minibars in other rooms. She opened the door, looked out into the hallway. It was empty.
"Candy bars it is,"
she said, realizing she just didn't have the nerve to go down to the restaurant. The room next door had a minibar, but no key in the lock. She tried three more rooms before realizing that she had just been lucky that first night. The refrigerators were all locked. But wait, maybe all the keys were interchangeable.
"Come on, back to our room," she said.
"Munchy, munchy,"
little Pete protested.
"Munchy, munchy,"
Astrid confirmed.
"Come on, Petey."
Out in the hallway again, and then she heard the ding of an elevator. The smooth electric motors opening the door. Was it Sam? She froze, poised between fear and hope. Fear won. The elevator was at the end of the hall and around a bend. She had seconds.
"Come on,"
she hissed, and pushed little Pete forward. With fumbling fingers, she slid the pass card into and out of the slot. Too fast. She had to do it slower. Again. Still no green light. One more time, and now she could hear the elevator door closing. It was him. Suddenly, she knew it was Drake.
"Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee."
It was the only prayer she could think of. She tried the key again. The light blinked to green. She turned the handle. He was there, at the end of the hall, standing there with a rifle over his shoulder and a gun in his hand. Astrid almost collapsed. Drake grinned. He raised the handgun and took aim. Astrid pushed little Pete into the room and tumbled in after him. Astrid slammed the door closed and threw the bolt. Then she added the security lock. An impossibly loud noise. The door had a hole in it the size of a dime, with the metal puckered out. Another explosion, and the door handle was hanging half off. Little Pete could save them. He could. He had the power. But he was still calm, still oblivious. Useless. The balcony. It was the only way.
"Petey, come on,"
she rasped.
"Munchy, munchy,"
he argued. Drake slammed against the door, but it held. The deadbolt was still in place. He fired again and again, frustrated, blasting away at the deadbolt. He was frantic that she and Petey would teleport again. She had to make him believe it had happened. She dragged little Pete to the balcony, slid open the door, looked down. The ground was too far, way too far. But there was a balcony directly below them. Astrid climbed over the railing, scared to death, shaking, but with no alternative. How could she get little Pete to follow? He was fixated on food now.
"Game Boy,"
she hissed, and pushed the toy close to his face.
"Come on, Petey, come on, Game Boy."
She guided her brother over, placed his hand on the rail, only one hand, because now he was in his game again, lost in his stupid game, too calm to use his power, too unpredictable.
"Blessed art thou among women, blessed is the fruit of thy womb, Jesus,"
Astrid sobbed. This wasn't going to work. She could make it, but how could she get her brother to do it? He was small. She could swing him. She could hold on for the few seconds it'd take.
"Holy Mary, Mother of God."
She gripped the railing with her left, grabbed little Pete's wrist with her right, and yanked him away from the rail. He fell. She caught him, held on by her fingernails, and then he was falling. He slammed onto the porch chair below. He had landed hard. He was stunned. Astrid heard Drake slamming against the door again, and heard a splintering sound as the deadbolt gave way. Now only the frail chain still held, and he would be through that in a heartbeat.
"Pray for us sinners now."
She swung herself down and landed almost on top of little Pete. No time for the sharp pain in her leg, no time for the blood and the scraped flesh, only time to grab little Pete, hug him, hold him close, and withdraw back against the sliding glass door of the balcony.
Window seat, baby, window seat,"
she whispered, her mouth pressed to his ear. She heard Drake in the room above. She heard him slide open the door above and step out onto the balcony. They were out of sight, unless he leaned out far enough. "Pray for us sinners now and at the hour of our death." She finished the prayer silently and held on to her brother. "Amen." She heard Drake curse in fury. They had done it. He thought they had disappeared. "Thank you, Lord," Astrid prayed silently. And then little Pete began to moan. His game had fallen when she had dropped him to the balcony. The back was open. One of the batteries had rolled away. And now little Pete was trying to make it work, and it wouldn't. Astrid almost sobbed out loud. Drake stopped cursing. She looked up, and there he was, leaning far out over the railing. The shark grin was wide. The gun was in his hand, but he couldn't quite get an angle on them, so he swung one leg over the railing, crouched just as Astrid had done, and now he could see them quite clearly. He aimed. He laughed. And then he bellowed in pain and fell. Astrid leapt to the railing. Drake was on the grass below, sprawled on his back, unconscious, lying on his rifle with the pistol beside him.
"Astrid," Sam said.
He was above her, still holding the table lamp he'd used to smash Drake's hand, leaning out over the railing.
"Sam!"
"You okay?"
"As soon as I get Petey's battery, I will be."
That sounded stupid, and she almost laughed.
"I have a boat down on the beach."
"Where are we going?"
"How about not here?"
25. 127 hours, 42 minutes. It had been 2 days since Lana had survived the coyotes. The talking coyotes. 2 days since her life had been saved by a snake. A flying snake. The world had gone crazy. Lana had watered the lawn that morning, careful to keep a sharp eye out for coyotes and snakes. She paid close attention to Patrick's every bark, growl, or twitch. He was her early warning system. They'd been owner and pet in the old days, or maybe you could say friends. But now they were a team. They were partners in a game of survival. Patrick's senses, her brain. It was a stupid thing to do, watering the lawn, since she couldn't be sure there would be water enough for her. But the man who had owned this tumble-down desert abode had loved the few square meters of grass. It was an act of defiance against the desert. Defiance, even though he had chosen to live out here in the middle of absolutely nowhere. Anyway, in a crazy world, why shouldn't she be crazy too? The man who owned the cabin was named Jim Brown. She found that out from papers inside his desk. Plain old Jim Brown. There was no picture of him, but he was only 48 years old, a little too young, Lana thought, to leave civilization behind and become a hermit. The shed behind the cabin was stacked to the roof with survival rations. Not a single fresh thing to be found, but enough canned crackers, canned peanut butter, peaches, fruit cocktail, chili, spam, and military-style meals ready to eat to last Lana and Patrick at least a year. Maybe longer. There was no phone, no TV or any electronics, no air conditioning to soften the brutal afternoon heat. There was no electricity at all. The only mechanical things were the windmill that turned the pump that brought water up from the aquifer below, and a foot-powered grindstone used to hone picks and shovels and saw blades. There were more than a few picks, shovels, saws, and hammers. There was evidence as well of a car or truck. Tire marks led through the sand from a sort of carport that sagged against the side of the house. There were empty oil cans in the trash, and 2 red 25-gallon steel tanks that smelled like they were full of gasoline. Out back was a stack of railroad ties, neatly formed into a square pile. Beside this was smaller lumber, a lot of it used 2x4s scarred by nails. Hermit Jim, as Lana thought of him, must be out. Maybe he had left forever. Maybe what had happened to her grandfather had happened to him, and now she was the only person left alive in the whole world. She didn't want to be there if he came back. There was no way to know whether you could trust a man who lived in a searing hot valley between dusty hills at the end of no road, and had a lawn as lush as a putting green. Lana finished watering the grass and sprayed Patrick playfully with the hose before turning it off.
"Want some chili, boy?"
she asked the dog. She led the way back inside. It was an oven in the cabin, so hot she started sweating before she had cleared the threshold. But Lana did not think she would ever complain about something so minor. Not after what she had endured. Heat? Big deal. She had water, she had food, and all her bones were unbroken, which was how she liked them. The chili came in a big number 10 can. With no refrigeration, they had to eat it before it could go bad, so it was chili meal after meal till it was gone. But at least there was fruit cocktail for dessert. Tomorrow, maybe she'd open one of the number 10 cans of vanilla pudding and just eat pudding for a couple of days. There was no oven, just a one-burner cooktop. No sink. There was a single chair and a table and an uncomfortable cot against a wall. The one decorative feature was a ratty Persian rug in the center of the only room. The best seat in the house was a smelly but comfortable lazy boy that sat on that rug. It was stuck in the recline position, but that was fine with Lana. She was all about reclining and taking things easy. The only thing to do was read. Hermit Jim had exactly 38 books. She had inventoried them. There were fairly recent novels by Patrick O'Brien, Dan Simmons, Stephen King, and Dennis Lehane, and some books that she supposed were philosophy by writers like Thoreau. There were classics whose names seemed familiar to her. Oliver Twist, The Seawolf, The Big Sleep, Ivanhoe. Nothing had exactly jumped out at her. There were no J.K. Rowling or Meg Cabot books. Nothing for kids at all. But over the course of the first day, she had read all of Pride and Prejudice, and now she was starting The Seawolf. Neither was an easy book. But Lana had nothing but time on her hands.
"We can't stay here, Patrick,"
Lana said, as the dog attacked his bowl of chili.
"Sooner or later we have to move on. My friends will be worried. Everyone will be. Even Mom and Dad. They must think we're dead."
But even as she said it, Lana had her doubts. There wasn't much to do once she had inventoried the groceries, so she spent most of her time sitting on the wooden chair, reading, or just watching the desert landscape. She would pull the chair into the doorway where she could have some shade and look out across the lawn at the hills around. She had mastered the trick of reading a paragraph at a time, looking up to scan the area for danger, checking Patrick for warning signs, then sinking back into the book for another paragraph. After a while, the unending emptiness took a toll on her never-strong sense of optimism. The barrier was still there. It was behind the cabin, not in her field of vision unless she stepped away from the cabin. Lana carried a tin cup of water toward the door, intending to drink it while having another look at the lawn, and suddenly, there was Patrick, racing toward her. His fur was up. He shook his head like he was having a seizure.
"Get in!"
Lana yelled. She held the door open. Patrick barreled in. She slammed the door and threw the bolt. Patrick hit the rug, skidded, rolled over twice, and came up to a sitting position. Something was in his mouth. Something alive. Lana approached, cautiously. She bent down to see.
"A horny toad? That's what you have? You scared me half to death over a horned toad?"
She felt her heart thud heavily as it restarted.
"Spit that thing out. Good grief, Patrick, I count on you and you freak out over a stupid horned toad?"
Patrick didn't want to give up his prize. Lana decided to let him have it. It was dead now anyway, and she supposed Patrick was entitled to his own version of crazy.
"Take it outside and you can keep it," she said.
She headed for the door, but knelt first to straighten the rug. Then she noticed the hatch in the floor. Lana pulled the rug back farther, folding it up over the lazy boy. She hesitated, not sure if she wanted to see what was under those floorboards. Maybe Hermit Jim was Serial Killer Jim. But it wasn't like she had anything else to do. She shoved the recliner aside and rolled up the rug. There was a recessed steel ring. She pulled it up. Lying in the space below were neatly stacked metal bricks, each maybe 6 or 8 inches long, half as wide, and a third as thick. There was no question in Lana's mind what they were.
"Gold, Patrick. Gold."
The gold bars were heavy, 20 pounds or more, but she lifted enough out to be able to see the extent of the pile. Her best estimate was that there were 14 in all, each at least 20 pounds. Lana had no idea what gold was worth, but she knew what a pair of gold hoop earrings cost.
"That is a lot of earrings,"
she said. Patrick looked into the hole with puzzlement.
"You know what this means, Patrick? All this gold here, and all those picks and shovels outside? Hermit Jim is a gold miner."
She ran outside to the lean-to where Hermit Jim had formerly parked his truck. Patrick bounded along, hoping for a game. Sometimes she tossed a broken axe handle for him to retrieve, but today Patrick was to be disappointed. For the first time, Lana carefully followed the tire tracks. They were fading, but still visible. 100 feet from the house, they split. Some tracks, older ones it seemed, headed one direction, southeast, probably toward Perdido Beach. Somewhat fresher tracks headed toward the base of the ridge to the north. Perdido Beach, she believed, could be 15, maybe 20 miles or so away, a very long walk in the heat. But if the mine was at the base of the ridge, it didn't look like even a tenth of that distance. Hermit Jim might be there. If he was, so was his truck. If he wasn't, his truck might still be there anyway. Lana felt a profound aversion to the idea of venturing into the wild again. She'd come very, very close to dying the last time. And the coyotes might still be out there, waiting patiently. But the mile to the mine? She could do that. She filled a plastic jug with water. She filled herself with water and made sure Patrick was hydrated, too. She stuffed her pockets with MREs, meals ready to eat, and packed more into a towel she twisted to form a pouch. She smeared herself with sunscreen from an emergency medical kit.
"Let's go for a walk, Patrick."
Edelio grinned as Astrid took her seat on the left side of the Boston Whaler.
"Thank God. Now at least we got one smart person on this boat."
Edelio and Quinn pushed the boat off the sand, back into the gently lapping surf. They climbed aboard, then trailed their legs over the side to clean off clinging sand. Sam headed the boat out to sea, out toward the barrier. He hoped Drake was dead, or at least badly injured. But he wasn't sure, and he wanted to get well away before the psychopath started shooting at them. It occurred to Sam that never before in his life had he wished someone dead. 8 days had passed since the coming of the phase. 8 days, and he'd seen enough craziness to last him a lifetime. And now he was fantasizing about a kid being dead. Once he pushed the throttle forward and was beyond the range of any bullet, he started to feel better. This was as close as Sam had come to surfing since the coming of the phase. The waves were unimpressive, short chop, but the whaler landed on them with wonderful force that translated up through his legs, rattled his teeth, and brought a smile to his lips. Salt spray was flying, and for Sam, it was hard to be grim when the spray was lashing his face.
"Thanks, Adelio."
"You too, Quinn," Sam said. He was still furious at Quinn, but they were, literally, all in the same boat now.
"See how much you want to thank me when I hurl all over this boat," Adelio said.
He was looking a little green. Sam reminded himself to keep a safe distance from the phase barrier, but at the same time, he wanted to keep it close. There was still the tantalizing possibility of a gap, a gate, an opening through which they could all sail and say goodbye to this madness. Far to the north, he could see the cliffs that marked the inlets occupied by the power plant. Beyond that, just a smudge in the haze, the outline of the nearest of half a dozen small private islands. Astrid had dug out the life jackets and was strapping one on to little Pete. Adelio accepted one, too, but Quinn refused. Astrid also found a small cooler packed with warm sodas, a loaf of bread, and the rest of the makings of peanut butter and jelly sandwiches.
"We won't starve," she said. "At least not right away."
The barrier was just to their left, a terrible, imposing blank wall. The waves lapped against it, an impatient sound. The water wanted to escape, too. Sam was a fish in an aquarium, and the phase wall was the side of the tank. It was the same semi-translucent mystery it was on land. He skimmed along until he was far enough out that Clifftop was no bigger than a Lego perched above a narrow ribbon of sand. Perdido Beach was like an oil painting, dots and splashes of color that suggested a town without providing any detail. "I'm going to try something," he announced. Sam killed the engine and let the boat wallow. The boat seemed to want to drift along the wall. There was a current, only slight, but definite. The current chased down the side of the wall, heading away from land, following the long curve still farther out to sea. "Do we have an anchor?" Sam asked. The answer was a retching sound. Sam looked away as Adelio gave up his lunch. "Never mind," said Sam. "I'll look." There was no anchor, but he noticed that Astrid was making peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. She handed one to Sam. He had not realized he was hungry. He stuffed half the sandwich in his mouth.
"This is why they call you Astrid the Genius," he mumbled through the peanut butter.
"Man, don't talk about food," Adelio groaned.
Sam searched his little boat. No anchor anywhere, but there were some plastic bumpers, which he hung over the side in case he brushed against the barrier. And there was a coil of blue and white nylon rope. He tied one end securely to a cleat and tied the other end around his ankle. He stripped off his shirt and kicked off his shoes, leaving him in shorts. Rummaging in one of the holds, he found a long screwdriver.
"What are you doing?" Quinn asked.
Sam ignored him.
"Adelio, man, you gonna live?"
"I hope not,"
Adelio said through gritted teeth. "I'm going to dive down, see if I can get below the barrier." Astrid looked skeptical, worried, but Sam could see she was in her own head, preoccupied, probably trying to come to grips with almost getting shot. Quinn said, "I'll haul you in if you get jammed up." Sam nodded, not ready to talk to Quinn. Not sure he would ever be ready to talk to Quinn. Then he dived off the side. The water was a welcome friend. Cold, a shock, but welcome. He laughed at the taste of salt. He took a couple of deep breaths, held the last one, and dived. He swam with powerful kicks and his free hand, while the other hand held the screwdriver out to fend off the phase wall. He had no desire to be pushed up against it. Touching with a finger had hurt. Laying a shoulder or thigh against it would not be pleasant. Down and down he went. He wished he'd had the foresight to grab some scuba gear, or at least a face mask and fins at the marina, but he'd been a bit preoccupied at the time. The water was pretty clear, but still, visibility was reduced in the shadow of the barrier. When he reached the end of his air, he stabbed toward the barrier. The screwdriver hit nothing, and he felt a momentary surge of excitement, that disappeared when his next thrust stopped dead against solid resistance. He shot to the surface and gasped for air. The barrier extended at least 20 feet down below the surface. If there was a bottom to it, he'd have to find it using an air tank and flippers. The boat was rocking against the barrier 50 feet away. He heard the distinct snap and pfft as Astrid popped open a Coke for little Pete. Quinn sat on the bow, tending the rope, and Adelio was still looking as if he might heave up a part of his liver. Sam swam to the boat, taking his time, enjoying the water on his skin too much to feel disappointed that he hadn't found a way out of the phase. He heard the sound of the engine and the smack-on wave impact long before he saw the boat. He kicked hard to lift his head above the water far enough to see. "Hey!" he yelled. Quinn had heard the engine at the same time. "Boat coming! Fast!" Quinn yelled. "Where?" "From town," Quinn reported. "Fast!" he repeated. 26. 126 hours, 10 minutes. Sam swam at full speed and soon had his hand on the gunwale of the Boston Whaler. Quinn hauled him aboard, up and over, falling and rolling onto the deck. He was on his feet in a flash and saw the big speedboat, the kind they called a cigarette boat, bearing down on them, not a quarter mile away. The boat threw out a huge bow wave. At the wheel was a kid Sam couldn't recognize from this distance. Standing like they were holding on for dear life were Howard and Ork. No Drake. "We can't outrun them," Quinn said. Adrenaline seemed to have steadied Adelio's stomach. "Maybe, man, but we don't know till we try." "No, Quinn's right," Sam said. "Astrid, hold on to little Pete." Adelio reeled up the slack in the rope, both hands flying. They couldn't leave it trailing in the water, or it would foul the propeller. As soon as the rope was aboard, Sam gunned the throttle and quickly picked up speed running along the barrier. Ork's boat veered to follow. Astrid, clutching her little brother, peeked over the side and yelled, "He's chasing, not aiming to intercept us!" It took Sam a second to understand what she meant. The cigarette boat could have set an intercept angle and easily cut them off, but the driver hadn't thought of that. Almost too late, the speedboat's driver veered right, trying to drop in behind Sam, but the turn was sloppy and the speed too great. The cigarette boat slid sideways into the barrier with a surprisingly loud bass drum smack. Then, when the props bit again, the cigarette boat surged forward and shot past the whaler. "Hold on," Sam warned. The wave from the cigarette boat's turn washed over the whaler and slammed the smaller boat against the barrier. Sam rocked, but held on, his bare feet fighting the crazily tilting deck for traction. The Boston Whaler stayed upright, and as the propeller found water again, it gained speed. They shot to the right of the cigarette boat, close enough that Sam could have stuck his arm out and high-fived Howard. Now the whaler was going all out, bouncing from wavetop to wavetop with the barrier flying by on the left, heading farther from land. But the speedboat was much faster, and now that the driver had recovered, he came roaring after Sam and was soon churning Sam's wake. "Pull over, moron!" Ork bellowed at Sam. Sam ignored the demand. His mind was racing. How could he get away? His boat was slower. It was more nimble, but it was definitely slower. And the speedboat was so much bigger, so much heavier, that it could run right over the Boston Whaler. "Pull over or we'll run you down!" Ork shouted again.
Don't be stupid, Sammy!
Howard yelled in a smaller voice, barely audible over the roar of engines and rush of water. Astrid was suddenly at his side.
Sam, can you do anything?
Maybe. I have an idea. In a tight whisper, she said,
Are you talking about...
I don't know how to do that, Astrid. It just happens. And this isn't exactly the time for me to consult Yoda on how to use my power. Adelio was with them now. You got a plan, Sam? Not a good one. Sam picked up the radio handset beside the throttle. He keyed the button. This is Sam. Are you guys receiving? Over. Glancing back, he saw the surprise on Howard's face. Yes, they were receiving. Howard lifted his handset and frowned at it. Sam keyed his radio. You hold down the button, Howard, Sam said. Then when you're done, you say over and let go of the button. Over.
You have to pull over, Howard said,
his voice harshened by the tinny receiver.
Oh, over.
I don't think we're going to do that, Howard. Drake tried to kill Astrid. You and Ork almost killed me, over. That occupied Howard for a minute while he thought up a good lie.
It's okay, Sammy. Kane changed his mind. He says if you behave yourselves, he'll let you all go free. Over.
Yeah, I absolutely believe you, Sam said. Sam edged his boat still closer to the barrier. It was so close now, he could have touched it. He depressed the send button again. You try to run me down, you may run into the barrier, Sam warned. Over. There was a silence. Then a new voice, faint but audible. It had to be coming from a radio on shore.
Get him, the voice commanded. Get him or don't come back.
Kane. He was using the radio he used to stay in contact with Drake and the daycare and the fire station. Howard said,
Hey, Kane, they have Astrid and the retard, too. And Quinn.
What? Say again. Astrid is with them?
It was Sam who answered him, relishing the moment, even though the triumph was likely to be short-lived. That's right, Kane. Your pet psycho failed you.
Get them all, Kane ordered. What if they use the power?
Howard whined.
If they could use the power, they'd already have done so, Kane said, with a smirk that carried across the airwaves. No excuses. Take them down. Kane out.
Astrid said,
Sam, if you can do it, you need to do it.
Do what?
Adelio demanded.
Oh, the thing?
The radio crackled to life again. Howard said,
You have till I count 10, Sammy. Then we hit it and run you down. Doesn't have to be like that, but we have no choice. So... 10.
Adelio, you and Astrid and Little Pete down on the deck. Quinn, you with them.
9.
Adelio pulled Astrid down beside him and lay flat on the deck with Little Pete between them.
8.
This better be a good plan, brah, Quinn said,
but he went and crouched with Astrid.
7. 6.
The bow of the cigarette boat towered above the stern of the whaler, a huge red cleaver bouncing up and down, chopping its way toward them. The roar of all three engines bounced off the barrier, twisting and amplifying the sound.
5!
He had a plan, but the plan was suicide.
4!
Everyone ready?
Ready for what? 3!
He's going to hit us.
That's your plan?
Quinn shrilled.
2!
Pretty much, Sam said.
1!
Sam heard the twin engines of the cigarette boat ramp up. The red meat cleaver bow leaped forward. It was like someone had strapped a rocket to the back. Sam shoved the throttle of the whaler into neutral and steered to scrape the left side of the boat into the phase wall. The whaler slowed very suddenly.
Hang on!
He dropped into a low crouch, kneeling on the wet deck, clutching the wheel with one hand and yanked it to the right, then steadied it. He covered his head with his free arm, shouting to keep his nerve up. The Boston Whaler slowed. The speedboat did not. The tall, dagger-sharp prow ran up over the left half of the Boston Whaler's stern. There was a screech of shattered fiberglass. The impact knocked Sam away from the wheel. The back end of the whaler plunged, and the five of them in the entire boat were suddenly underwater. Sam was yelling into water, yelling and fighting to avoid being sucked up into the propellers that tornadoed the water a millimeter above his head. The speedboat blocked out the sun, deep red and death white, a knife drawn across the smaller boat. The big twin outboard engine screamed. But the cigarette boat didn't entirely crush the smaller boat. Instead, hitting the whaler at an angle, the cigarette boat went airborne like a stunt car hitting a ramp. It rolled in midair and smashed its topside into the barrier, shattering its windshield and crumpling its railings. The cigarette boat hit the water hard on its side 20 feet ahead of the Boston Whaler. It landed in a sideways belly flop, plowed so deep Sam thought it might stay under, but then it wallowed back up like a surfacing submarine and righted itself. The whaler had taken a bad beating. The stern was crushed. The railings on the left side were gone. The black-cowled engine was askew, but still attached. There was a big divot smashed out of the fiberglass on the bow. 2 feet of water sloshed on the deck. The command console was bent forward and to the side so that the steering wheel was askew, and the throttle handle was out of its slot and hanging loose. The engine had been swamped and had sputtered out. But Sam was not hurt.
"Astrid!"
he yelled, terrified when he didn't see her immediately. Little Pete was alone, staring, almost as if this at least had really penetrated his consciousness. Quinn and Adelio jumped up and leaned over the back. They had spotted Astrid's slender hand holding the railing. They pulled her aboard, half drowned and bleeding from a gash in her leg. "Is she okay?" Adelio nodded, too waterlogged to answer. Sam turned the key and hoped. The big mercury motor roared. The throttle was stiff, jammed, but by pushing with all his might, he could shift it forward. The crooked wheel still turned. The cigarette boat was just ahead, stalled. Ork was in the water, yelling in fury. Howard scampered around looking for a life jacket while the driver tried to restart the engines. Unfortunately, the engines did not appear to be damaged. It was now or never. With frantic fingers, Sam untied the rope from his ankle and took the loose end in his teeth. He jumped into the water and plowed through the few feet of water separating the whaler from the speedboat.
"He's swimming over here! His boat is sinking!"
the speedboat driver yelled, misunderstanding. But Howard knew better.
"He's up to something!"
Sam dove down under the water. It had to be now, before the driver got the engine started. If those props started turning, it would be too late, and there was a very good chance that Sam would lose his fingers or even a whole hand. Fighting his own buoyancy, Sam stayed under, peering through the churn, fingers trying to make sense of... There. That was one propeller. He looped the nylon rope around the rightward prop and twisted it as tight as he could. Then he jetted to his left, blowing out the last of his air so he could stay submerged. He heard the ignition click, the key being turned over. One twist of the boat driver's fingers and... the engine gave a start. Sam pushed back in panic. Both props jerked and churned. Then the right prop seized, and the left spun and stopped. With the last of his strength, Sam wound the rope around the left propeller, kicked off from the stern, and surfaced a few feet away for a quick gasp of air. He heard the engines turn over again and stall again. The cigarette boat's driver now realized what had happened, and Howard was at the stern, shouting angry threats. Sam twisted and started swimming hard for the whaler, which was bouncing against the barrier.
"Sam!"
It was Astrid shouting.
"Behind you!"
The blow came out of nowhere. Sam's head spun. His eyes wouldn't focus. The muscles in his limbs were all slack. He'd been here before. It was just like when he'd fallen off his surfboard, and it had come back and hit him. A corner of his mind knew what to do. Avoid panic. Take a few seconds to let his head clear. Only this wasn't a surfboard. A second impact hit just beside him, missing his head and hitting his collarbone. The sharp pain helped Sam focus. He saw Howard raise the long aluminum boat hook for a third blow, and now Sam avoided it easily. As the boat hook slapped the water, Sam lunged, bringing all his weight onto it. Howard lost his balance, and Sam yanked. Howard let go of the boat hook and slammed chest first onto one of the engines. Again, Sam turned toward the whaler, but too late. Ork was on him now, and while one giant hand grabbed for a purchase on Sam's neck, the other pounded at him. Ork's fist hit water before it hit Sam's nose, so it was slowed down, but still, the impact was shocking. Sam curled into a ball and drove both his legs as hard as he could into Ork's solar plexus. His blow, too, was slowed by the drag of the water, but it pushed Sam forward and Ork back. Sam was the better swimmer, but Ork was stronger. As Sam tried to escape, Ork grabbed the waist of Sam's shorts and held him firmly. Howard was on his feet now, shouting encouragement and praise for Ork. The fight was directly beneath the whaler's crunched bow. Sam somersaulted backward, slammed his bare feet against the hull, and pushed himself down under the water. He hoped when Ork's head submerged, he'd panic and let go. It worked, and Sam was free. Free, but trapped in a tight corner between the phase wall and the boat's bow. Ork's face was a fright mask of rage. He came straight at Sam, and Sam had no choice at all. He waited for Ork, grabbed his shirt as he came in range, twisted, and, using Ork's own momentum, drove the bully face first into the phase wall. Ork screamed. He flailed madly and screamed again. Sam kicked away, using Ork's body as a launch pad. The kick drove Ork sideways into the barrier, and he bellowed like a dying bull. Sam swam, snagged the starboard gunwale, and held on.
"Adelio, go!"
Adelio threw the throttle forward as Sam, with a hand from Astrid and Quinn, pulled himself aboard. Ork was yelling incoherent, half-drowned curses from the water. Howard was reaching down to him, and the boat's driver was shell-shocked, not sure what to do. The rope was firmly tied to the deck cleat. The cleat would never hold, but a good sharp snap might finish off at least one of the jammed props. Adelio turned the whaler away from the barrier and said,
"Watch the rope, Sam."
The warning was just in time, as the slack came off the rope and it shot up out of the water. The rope tightened, nearly snapping Sam's arm in the process. The whaler jerked from the impact. The cleat tore from the deck. But the cigarette boat's props were useless now.
"Okay, that was crazy," Adelio said with a laugh.
"I guess you're over the seasickness now?"
The radio crackled to life. Howard's familiar voice, subdued and afraid now, whining.
"This is Howard. They got away."
The faint voice from shore answered,
"Why am I not surprised?"
Then, Howard again.
"Our boat doesn't work."
"Sam," Kane said, "if you can hear me, brother, you better know I'll kill you."
"Brother? Why is he calling you brother?"
Astrid asked. "Long story." Sam smiled. Plenty of time to tell stories now. They'd done it. They had escaped. But it was a hollow victory. Now they couldn't go home.
"Okay,"
Sam said.
"So it's escape or nothing."
He set the tiller on a course that followed the long, curved barrier. Astrid found a cut-top bleach bottle and began the long job of bailing out the boat.
27. 125 hours, 57 minutes.
It took Lana far longer than she had expected to reach the end of the tire tracks. What had looked like a mile at most must have been three, and carrying the water and the food in the blazing heat had not made it easy. It was afternoon by the time she dragged her weary feet around an outcropping from the ridge. There, before her amazed eyes, was what looked very much like an abandoned mining town. It must have been quite a camp once. There were a dozen buildings, all jumbled together in the narrow, steep-walled crease of the ridge. The buildings were almost indistinguishable from one another now, mere collections of gray sticks. But there might once have been a sort of street, no more than half a block long. It was a spooky place, silent, gloomy, with wrecked glassless windows like sad eyes staring down at her. Behind the wreckage of the main street, out of sight of casual passers-by, although why anyone would ever come to this desolate, unlovely place Lana could not imagine, was a more sturdy structure. It was built of the same gray lumber, but was still upright and topped with a tin roof. This structure was the size of a three-car garage. The tracks led there.
"Come on, boy,"
Lana said. Patrick ran ahead, sniffed at a weed near the shed's door, and came back, tail still high.
"So there's no one inside,"
Lana reassured herself.
"Or else you would have barked."
She threw the door open, not wanting to creep in like some girl in a horror movie. Sunlight came through dozens of holes and seams in the tin roof and knotholes in the wood. Still, it was dark. The truck was there. Newer than her grandfather's truck, with a longer bed.
"Hello? Hello?"
She waited. Then,
"Hello?"
She checked the truck first. The tank was half full. The keys were nowhere to be found. She searched every square inch of the truck, and nothing. Frustrated, Lana began a search of the rest of the shack. It was mostly machinery. What looked like a rock crusher. Something that looked like a big vat with heat jets positioned beneath. A liquid petroleum gas tank that sat off in a corner.
Okay, we either find the keys and probably kill ourselves driving,
Lana summarized to an attentive Patrick.
Or we walk however many miles through the heat to Perdido Beach and maybe die of thirst.
Patrick barked.
I agree. Let's keep looking for the keys.
In addition to the tall double door on the front of the shed, there was a smaller door in the back. Through this, Lana found a well-trodden path that wound through ugly piles of rock, past a graveyard of rusted steel machines, and ended in a timber-framed opening in the ground. It looked like the mountain's surprised mouth, a crooked square of black with two broken support beams forming jagged buck teeth. A narrow train track led into the mine.
I don't think we want to go in there,
Lana said. Patrick moved cautiously closer to the opening. His hackles went up, and he growled. But he wasn't growling at the opening. Lana heard the rush of padded feet. Down the side of the mountain, like a silent avalanche, raced a pack of coyotes, maybe two dozen of them, maybe more. They flowed down the mountain with shocking speed, and as they came, Lana could hear them whispering in strained, glottal voices,
"Food! Food!"
No,
Lana told herself. No, she had to be imagining that. Lana shot a panicked look over her shoulder back at the shack, now far below her. The right wing of the pack was already racing to cut her off.
Patrick!
She yelled, and bolted for the mine entrance. The instant they were past the threshold of the mine, the temperature dropped 20 degrees. Like stepping into air conditioning. There was no light but that which came from outside, and Lana's eyes had no time to adjust. There was a terrible smell. Something foul, sweet, and cloying. Patrick turned back to face the coyotes and bristled. The coyotes boiled around the entrance to the mine, but stopped there. Lana, half-blind, felt around in the dark for something, anything. She found rocks as big as a man's fist. She began hurling, not aiming, just frantically flinging the rocks at the coyotes.
Go away! Shoo! Get out of here!
None of Lana's missiles connected with a target. The coyotes sidestepped them daintily, effortlessly, like they were playing a not very challenging game. The pack split in two, forming a lane. One coyote, not the biggest, but by far the ugliest, walked with head high through the pack. One of his oversized ears was half torn off. He had mange that left bare patches of skin showing on the side of his shrewd muzzle, and the teeth on the left side of his mouth were partly exposed by some long-ago injury that had given him a permanent sideways snarl. The coyote leader growled at her. She flinched, but raised a large rock in threat.
Stay back!
Lana warned.
No human here.
The voice was slurred, like dragged boots on wet gravel, but high-pitched. For several long seconds, Lana just stared. It wasn't possible. But it sounded as if the voice had come from the coyote.
What?
Go out,
the coyote said. This time it was unmistakable. She had seen his muzzle move, caught the struggle of his tongue behind sharp teeth.
You can't talk,
Lana said.
This isn't real.
Go out.
You'll kill me,
Lana said.
Yes. Go out. Die fast. Stay. Die slow.
You can talk,
Lana said, feeling like she was crazy. Really crazy now. The coyote didn't respond. Lana stalled.
Why can't I stay in the mine?
No human here.
Why?
Go out.
Come on, Patrick,
Lana said in a shaky whisper. She began backing away from the coyote pack leader, deeper into the darkness. Her foot hit something. She glanced down quickly and saw a leg sticking out of overalls caked with blood. She had found the source of the smell. Hermit Jim had been dead for a long time. She hopped backward over the body, putting it between herself and the coyote.
You killed him,
Lana accused.
Yes.
Why?
She spotted a lantern, just a big square flashlight, really. She bent quickly and picked it up.
No human here.
The coyote yapped a command to his pack, and they rushed into the cave and leapt over the body. Lana and Patrick turned and ran. Lana fumbled with the light as she ran, trying to find a switch. The darkness was quickly total. A sharp pain in her ankle almost brought her down, but she stumbled on. She found the switch, and suddenly the mine shaft was bathed in eerie light that revealed only jagged rock and straining wooden beams. The shadows were like claw fingers closing around her. The coyotes, startled by the light, fell back. Their eyes glittered. Their teeth were faint white grins. And then they came for her. A jaw-like vice closed around the muscle of her calf, and she fell in a heap. The coyotes swarmed over her. Their stink was in her nose. Their weight hammered her down. She fought to get up onto her elbows. A second vice closed over her upper arm, and she fell, knowing she would never get back up. She heard Patrick's terrified barking, so much deeper and louder than the coyote's excited yip-yapping. All at once, the coyotes released her. They yelped in surprise and pranced and twisted their heads left and right. Lana lay bleeding from a dozen bites in an eerie circle of light cast by the lantern. The pack leader snarled, and the coyotes calmed down at least a little, though it was clear that something had frightened them, and was still frightening them. The coyotes stirred, nervous, jumpy. All ears pricked up and turned toward the deep shadows farther down the shaft, like they were hearing something. Lana strained to hear what they heard, but the sobbing rasp of her own breathing was too loud. Her heart pounded like a pile driver, like it would break her ribs with its pounding. The coyotes no longer attacked her. Something had changed. Something in the air. Something in their unfathomable canine minds. She had gone from prey to prisoner. The coyote pack leader approached slowly and nosed her.
Walk, human.
She bent low and laid her hand against the worst of the bite wounds. The pain ebbed as the healing began, but she was still draining blood from a dozen small punctures as she stood and walked deeper into the cave. Deeper, with Patrick staying close and the coyotes following behind. Down and down they went. The train track ran out, and they entered what looked like a new section of tunnel.